Chapter 4. The preaching. About 6:45 there was an unusual appearance of excitement in the village of Haslip, and through the whole length of its little street, from the Donathern Arms to the churchyard gate, the inhabitants had evidently been drawn out of their houses by something more than the pleasure of lounging in the evening sunshine. The Donathern Arms stood at the entrance of the village, and a small farmyard and stackyard which flanked it, indicating that there was a pretty take of land attached to the inn, gave the traveller a promise of good feed for himself and his horse, which might well console him for the ignorance in which the weather-beaten sign left him, as to the heraldic bearings of that ancient family, the Donatherns. Mr. Casson, the landlord, had been for some time standing at the door with his hands in his pockets, balancing himself on his heels and toes, and looking towards a piece of unenclosed ground, with a maple in the middle of it, which he knew to be the destination of certain grave-looking men and women whom he had observed passing at intervals. Mr. Casson's person was by no means of that common type which can be allowed to pass without description. On a front view it appeared to consist principally of two spheres, bearing about the same relation to each other as the earth and the moon. That is to say, the lower sphere might be said, at a rough guess, to be 13 times larger than the upper, which naturally performed the function of a mere satellite and tributary. But here the resemblance ceased, for Mr. Casson's head was not at all a melancholy-looking satellite, nor was it a potty globe, as Milton has irreverently called the moon. On the contrary, no head and face could look more sleek and healthy, and its expression, which was chiefly confined to a pair of round and ruddy cheeks, the slight knot and interruptions forming the nose, and eyes being scarcely worth mention, was one of jolly contentment, only tempered by that sense of personal dignity which usually made itself felt in his attitude and bearing. This sense of dignity could hardly be considered excessive in a man who had been butler to a family for 15 years, and who, in his present high position, was necessarily very much in contact with his inferiors. How to reconcile his dignity with the satisfaction of his curiosity, by walking towards the green, was the problem that Mr. Casson had been revolving in his mind for the last 5 minutes. But when he had partly solved it, by taking his hands out of his pockets, and thrusting them into the armholes of his waistcoat, by throwing his head on one side, and providing himself with an air of contemptuous indifference to whatever might fall under his notice, his thoughts were diverted by the approach of the horseman whom we lately saw pausing, to have another look at our friend Adam, and who now pulled up at the door of the Donathern Arms. "Take off the bridle, and give him a drink, ostler," said the traveller to the lad in a smock frock, who had come out of the yard at the sound of the horse's hoofs. "Why, what's up in your pretty village, landlord?" he continued, getting down. "Here seems to be quite a stir. It's a Methodist's preaching, sir. It's been Jeff out as a young woman's a-going to preach on the green," answered Mr. Casson, in a treble and wheezy voice, with a slightly mincing accent. "Ill you please to step in, sir, and take something?" "No, I must be getting on to Rossiter. I only want a drink for my horse. And what does your parson say, I wonder, to a young woman preaching just under his nose?" "Parson Irwin, sir, doesn't live here. He lives at Broxon, over the hill there. The parsonage here's a tumble-down place, sir, not fit for gentry to live in. He comes here to preach of a Sunday afternoon, sir, and puts up his hoss here. It's a grey cob, sir, and he sets great store bit. He's allays put up his hoss here, sir, iver since before I had the Donathern Arms. I'm not this countryman, you may tell by my tongue, sir. They're currus talkers I this country, sir. The gentry's hard work to understand them. I was brought up among the gentry, sir, and got the turn o' their tongue when I was a bye. Why, what do you think the folks here says for heaven you? ' the gentry, you know, says, heaven you well, the people about here says Annie. Apostrophe, apostrophe, it's what they call the Dillick as it spoke here about, sir. That's what I've heard Squire Donathan say many a time. It's the Dillick, says he. I, said the stranger, smiling. Know it very well. But you've not got many Methodists about here, surely in this agricultural spot? I should have thought there would hardly be such a thing as a Methodist to be found about here. You're all farmers, aren't you? The Methodists can seldom lay much hold on them. Why, sir, there's a pretty lot o' workmen round about, sir. There's Mr. Burge as owns the timber yard over there. He undertakes a good bit o' building and repairs. And there's the stone pits not far off. There's plenty of employ this countryside, sir. And there's a fine batch o' Methodists at Treadlisten, that's the market town about 3 mile off. You'll maybe ha' come through it, sir. There's pretty nigh a score of them on the green now, as come from there. That's where our people gets it from, though there's only 2 men of them in all Haslip. That's Will Maskery, the wheelwright, and Seth Mead, a young man as works at the carpenterin'. The preacher comes from Treadleston, then, does she? Nay, sir, she comes out o' Stonyshire, pretty nigh 30 mile off. But she's a visitin' here about at Mr. Poyser's at the Hall Farm. It's them barns and big walnut trees, right away to the left, sir. She's own niece to Poyser's wife, and they'll be fine, and vexed at her for making a fool of herself I that way. But I've heard as there's no holding these Methodists, when the maggots once got I their head. Many of them goes stark staring mad why their religion. Though this young woman's quiet enough to look at, by what I can make out, I've not seen her myself. Well, I wish I had time to wait and see her, but I must get on. I've been out of my way for the last 20 minutes, to have a look at that place in the valley. It's Squire Donathan's, I suppose? Yes, sir, that's Donathan Chase, that is. Fine oaks there, isn't there, sir? I should know what it is, sir, for I've lived butler there a going I 15 year. It's Captain Donathan as is THR, Sir Squire Donathan's grandson. He'll be coming of age this a harvest, sir, and we shall have fine doings. He owns all the land about here, sir, Squire Donathan does. Well, it's a pretty spot, whoever may own it, said the traveler, mounting his horse. And one meets some fine strapping fellows about too. I met as fine a young fellow as ever I saw in my life, about half an hour ago, before I came up the hill a carpenter, a tall, broad-shouldered fellow with black hair and black eyes, marching along like a soldier. We want such fellows as he to lick the French. Aye, sir, that's Adam Bede, that is, I'll be bound Thias Bede's son everybody knows him hereabout. He's an uncommon clever steady fellow, and wonderful strong. Lord bless you, sir, if you'll excuse me for saying, so he can walk 40 mile a day, and lift a matter o' 60 stone. He's an uncommon favorite why the gentry, sir. Captain Donathan and Parson Irwin makes a fine fuss why him. But he's a little lifted up and peppery-like. Well, good evening to you, landlord. I must get on. Your servant, sir. Good evening. The traveler put his horse into a quick walk up the village, but when he approached the green, the beauty of the view that lay on his right hand, the singular contrast presented by the groups of villagers with the knot of Methodists near the maple, and perhaps yet more, curiosity to see the young female preacher, proved too much for his anxiety to get to the end of his journey, and he paused. The green lay at the extremity of the village, and from it the road branched off in 2 directions, one leading farther up the hill by the church, and the other winding gently down towards the valley. On the side of the green, that led towards the church, the broken line of thatched cottages was continued nearly to the churchyard gate, but on the opposite northwestern side, there was nothing to obstruct the view of gently swelling meadow, and wooded valley, and dark masses of distant hill. That rich undulating district of Loamshire to which Haslip belonged lies close to a grim outskirt of Stonyshire, overlooked by its barren hills as a pretty blooming sister may sometimes be seen linked in the arm of a rugged, tall swarthy brother, and in 2 or 3 hours ride the traveler might exchange a bleak treeless region, intersected by lines of cold gray stone, for one where his road wound under the shelter of woods, or upswelling hills, muffled with hedgerows and long meadow grass and thick corn, and where at every turn he came upon some fine old country seat nestled in the valley or crowning the slope, some homestead with its long length of barn, and its cluster of golden ricks, some gray steeple looking out from a pretty confusion of trees and thatch and dark red tiles. It was just such a picture as this last, that Hayslope Church had made to the traveler as he began to mount the gentle slope leading to its pleasant uplands, and now from his station near the green he had before him in one view nearly all the other typical features of this pleasant land. High up against the horizon were the huge conical masses of hill, like giant mounds intended to fortify this region of corn and grass against the keen and hungry winds of the north, not distant enough to be clothed in purple mystery, but with somber greenish sides visibly specked with sheep, whose motion was only revealed by memory, not detected by sight. Wooed from day to day by the changing hours, but responding with no change in themselves, left forever grim and sullen after the flush of morning, the winged gleams of the April noonday, the parting crimson glory of the ripening summer sun. And directly below them the eye rested on a more advanced line of hanging woods, divided by bright patches of pasture or furrowed crops, and not yet deepened into the uniform leafy curtains of high summer, but still showing the warm tints of the young oak, and the tender green of the ash and lime. Then came the valley, where the woods grew thicker, as if they had rolled down, and hurried together from the patches left smooth on the slope, that they might take the better care of the tall mansion which lifted its parapets, and sent its faint blue summer smoke among them. Doubtless there was a large sweep of park, and a broad glassy pool in front of that mansion, but the swelling slope of meadow would not let our traveler see them from the village green. He saw instead a foreground which was just as lovely, the level sunlight lying like transparent gold among the gently curving stems of the feathered grass and the tall red sorrel, and the white ambles of the hemlocks lining the bushy hedgerows. It was that moment in summer, when the sound of the scythe, being whetted, makes us cast more lingering looks at the flower-sprinkled tresses of the meadows. He might have seen other beauties in the landscape, if he had turned a little in his saddle and looked eastward, beyond Jonathan Burge's pasture and woodyard towards the green corn fields and walnut trees of the Hall Farm, but apparently there was more interest for him in the living groups close at hand. Every generation in the village was there, from old Ether Taft in his brown worsted nightcap, who was bent nearly double, but seemed tough enough to keep on his legs a long while, leaning on his short stick, down to the babies with their little round heads lolling forward in quilted linen caps. Now and then there was a new arrival, perhaps a slouching laborer, who, having eaten his supper, came out to look at the unusual scene with a slow bovine gaze, willing to hear what anyone had to say in explanation of it, but by no means excited enough to ask a question. But all took care not to join the Methodists on the green, and identify themselves in that way with the expectant audience, for there was not one of them that would not have disclaimed the imputation of having come out to hear the 3-acre woman they had only come out to see had war a goin' on, like. The men were chiefly gathered in the neighborhood of the blacksmith's shop. But do not imagine them gathered in a knot. Villagers never swarm. A whisper is unknown among them, and they seem almost as incapable of an undertone as a cow or a stag. Your true rustic turns his back on his interlocutor, throwing a question over his shoulder, as if he meant to run away from the answer, and walking a step or two farther off when the interest of the dialogue culminates. So the group in the vicinity of the blacksmith's door was by no means a close one, and formed no screen in front of Chad Cranich, the blacksmith himself, who stood with his black brawny arms folded, leaning against the doorpost, and occasionally sending forth a bellowing laugh at his own jokes, giving them a marked preference over the sarcasms of Wiry Ben, who had renounced the pleasures of the holly bush for the sake of seeing life under a new form. But both styles of wit were treated with equal contempt by Mr. Joshua Rann. Mr. Rand's leathern apron and subdued griminess can leave no one in any doubt that he is the village shoemaker. The thrusting out of his chin and stomach and the twirling of his thumbs are more subtle indications, intended to prepare unwary strangers for the discovery that they are in the presence of the parish clerk. L.D. Joshua, as he is irreverently called by his neighbors, is in a state of simmering indignation. But he has not yet opened his lips except to say, in a resounding bass undertone, like the tuning of a violoncello, "See him, King of the Amorites, for his mercy endureth forever, and Og the King of Basin, for his mercy endureth forever," a quotation which may seem to have slight bearing on the present occasion. But, as with every other anomaly, adequate knowledge will show it to be a natural sequence. Mr. Rann was inwardly maintaining the dignity of the church in the face of this scandalous eruption of Methodism, and as that dignity was bound up with his own sonorous utterance of the responses, his argument naturally suggested a quotation from the psalm he had read the last Sunday afternoon. The stronger curiosity of the women had drawn them quite to the edge of the green, where they could examine more closely the Quaker-like costume and odd deportment of the female Methodists. Underneath the maple there was a small cart, which had been brought from the wheelwright's, to serve as a pulpit, and round this a couple of benches and a few chairs had been placed. Some of the Methodists were resting on these, with their eyes closed, as if wrapped in prayer meditation. Others chose to continue standing, and had turned their faces towards the villagers with a look of melancholy compassion, which was highly amusing to Bessie Cranage, the blacksmith's buxom daughter, known to her neighbors as Chats Bess, who wondered why the folks wore makin' faces at that'ns. Chats Bess was the object of peculiar compassion, because her hair, being turned back under a cap which was set at the top of her head, exposed to view an ornament of which she was much prouder than of her red cheeks, namely, a pair of large round earrings with false garnets in them, ornaments condemned not only by the Methodists, but by her own cousin and namesake Timothy's Bess, who, with much cousinly feeling, often wished them earrings might come to good. Timothy's Bess, though retaining her maiden appellation among her familiars, had long been the wife of Sandy Jim, and possessed a handsome set of matronly jewels, of which it is enough to mention the heavy baby she was rocking in her arms, and the sturdy fellow of 5 in knee breeches, and red legs, who had a rusty milk can round his neck by way of drum, and was very carefully avoided by Chat's small terrier. This young olive branch, notorious under the name of Timothy's Bess's Ben, being of an inquiring disposition, unchecked by any false modesty, had advanced beyond the group of women and children, and was walking round the Methodists, looking up in their faces with his mouth wide open, and beating his stick against the milk can by way of musical accompaniment. But one of the elderly women bending down to take him by the shoulder, with an air of grave remonstrance, Timothy's Bess's Ben first kicked out vigorously, then took to his heels and sought refuge behind his father's legs. "Ye gallows young dog," said Sandy Jim, with some paternal pride, "if ye donna keep that stick quiet, I'll take it from ye." What? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.